A show of unity at the White House for the applications from Finland and Sweden to join NATO.
Finland and Sweden make NATO stronger.
Plus, how those who fled Mariupol still fear the Russians.
Прописку там полностью оставили все наши данные.
Russians have all the information about us listed in their databases.
And later in the program, who are the Cossacks and what is their role in Russia's war against Ukraine? Today is Thursday, May 19th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Herman, in for Steve Miller. At the White House on Thursday, President Joe Biden, just before he departed on a trip to Asia, hosted leaders from Finland and Sweden a day after the two countries formally applied to join the West's military alliance, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, a decision prompted by Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
Finland and Sweden make NATO stronger. Not just because of their capacity, but their strong, strong democracies. And a strong, united NATO is the foundation of America's security. By joining NATO, allies make a sacred commitment to one another, that an attack on one is an attack against all.
Biden added that the admission of additional countries into NATO shouldn't be seen as a threat to any other country, an obvious reference to Russia. The U.S. president and his two guests spoke in the Rose Garden of the White House. Finland's president, Sauli Niinisto, expressed hope for strong support from all NATO allies and for a swift ratification of its membership.
I want to assure that Finland will become a strong NATO ally. We take our security very seriously. The Finnish armed forces are one of the strongest in Europe. We have also consistently invested in developing our capabilities. The Finns' willingness to defend their country is one of the highest in the whole world.
Sweden's Prime Minister Magdalena Andersson said she and Finland, which she explained to Biden, have responded forcefully to Russia's aggression and provided unprecedented support to Ukraine, are now taking the next step.
After 200 years of military non-alignment, Sweden has chosen a new path. Yesterday, Sweden and Finland submitted our formal requests to join NATO. And Russia's full-scale aggression against a sovereign and democratic neighbor, that was a watershed moment for Sweden. And my government has come to the conclusion that the security of the Swedish people will be best protected within the NATO alliance.
The application by the two countries must be approved by all current NATO members. Turkey is the only one at this point to express opposition, accusing them of giving haven to the Kurdistan Workers' Party, known as the PKK, which has staged armed resistance over Turkey's treatment of millions of Kurdish citizens. NATO's chief, Jens Stoltenberg, said he is confident Turkey's concerns will be resolved, and Niinisto at the White House said Finland is willing to address all of Ankara's concerns. Meanwhile, Estonia's government moved fast and decided on Thursday to approve the request by Finland and Sweden to join NATO. Russia's defense ministry said Thursday hundreds more Ukrainian soldiers had surrendered at the besieged Azovstal steel plant in Mariupol, bringing the total this week to 1,730. The International Committee of the Red Cross said in a statement it was registering fighters who left Azovstal, an operation that began Tuesday and was continuing Thursday. The ICRC says it is not transporting prisoners of war to the places where they are held, and the registration process that it facilitated involves the individual filling out of forms with personal details like name, date of birth, and closest relative, so it can track those who have been captured and help them keep in touch with their families. Ukrainian officials have not confirmed the Russian account of the number of Ukrainian fighters who have surrendered at the last holdout in Mariupol. Ukraine has expressed hopes that the soldiers can be part of a prisoner swap with Russia, while Russia's main investigative body said it intends to interrogate them and determine if any were involved in crimes against civilians. The capture of Mariupol, a pre-war city of 430,000 people along the north coast of the Sea of Azov, would be Moscow's biggest success in its nearly three-month offensive against Ukraine. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Zaporizhia, Ukraine, that in recent months, many risked everything to get out of Mariupol, but even now, they still live in fear.
After months of bombardments, Russia and Ukraine finally agreed this month on the evacuation of some civilians trapped underground in Mariupol, a key port city now in Russia's control. UN officials said they evacuated hundreds of people, but it is unknown how many others remain inside and are trying to get out.
I cannot know how many people are there, but we know by the people that left that much more are there.
Most people who fled Mariupol after the February invasion began left individually or in small groups, often flying white rags on their vehicles to show they are not combatants. Aid workers set up tents with food and other basics in a superstore parking lot here in Zaporizhia, a city not far from the war zones, but still firmly in Ukrainian control. By the time families arrived here to find their way to refugee centers or housing with friends and families, they were exhausted and often emotionally devastated. At a nearby underground shelter, one father tells us, even after they settle in a relatively safe place, families are still afraid.
Russians have all the information about us listed in their databases. If you leave their areas, you go through filtration and they take a print of every finger and your palm. They take all passport details.
Despite this danger, he said, they had to leave because inside the war zone, life was unsustainable. He said bodies littered the ground.
My small daughter wanted to play outside, but it was impossible. Missiles were flying outside, and when they exploded, the damage was massive.
Early this week, Ukrainian leaders said their battle for Mariupol was over, urging commanders on the ground to save the lives of remaining soldiers. Hundreds of soldiers were evacuated from Azovstal, a steel company with underground bunkers built for nuclear war. Many of the Ukrainian military evacuees are now in areas controlled by Russia. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Zaporizhia, Ukraine.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Herman. A Russian soldier facing the first war crimes trial since the start of the war in Ukraine has testified that he shot a civilian on orders from two officers. 21-year-old Sergeant Vadim Shismarin on Thursday pleaded for his victim's widow to forgive him. He told the court that one officer insisted that the Ukrainian man who was speaking on his cell phone could pinpoint their location to Ukrainian forces. He said initially he disobeyed an officer's order to shoot the man, but he said he had to follow the order when it was repeated by another officer. The victim's widow is also attending the trial. Katerina Shelepolba told the court the Russian soldier deserves a life sentence, but could be swapped for a Ukrainian prisoner of war. Russia's invasion of Ukraine, meant to expand Moscow's status as a regional or global power to be reckoned with, ironically could see President Vladimir Putin scrambling to maintain geopolitical relevancy. Here to discuss this now is Max Bergman, the director of the Europe Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Welcome to Flashpoint Ukraine.
Thanks so much for having me.
Max, you recently wrote that as a result of economic sanctions and Russia's performance on the battlefield, Moscow finds itself in a huge hole. How do you see President Putin digging out of that hole?
Well, I think it's going to be very tough. Let's be clear, the invasion of Ukraine was a huge geopolitical own goal. If we sort of set aside the actual specifics of what's happening on the ground in Ukraine, the end result has been massive international isolation for Russia, has been massive economic sanctions, and now export controls, which basically prevent the import of advanced technology items. So things like semiconductors, but also things like machine parts that Russia would need to import from Germany to keep auto factories and tank factories going. How Russia maintains its sort of great power status going forward is going to be a real struggle. It's going to be a priority for President Putin, but it's going to be a real struggle.
There's an argument that in the long run, time is on Russia's side, that it can negotiate a military settlement concerning Ukraine to its advantage and wait for the impact of those sanctions you referred to fade.
I think that's their best course of action, right? So right now, Russia's hope is that the West effectively lose interest in this conflict, lose interest in keeping the kind of screws turned on the Russian economy. And what we've seen, with the sanctions that were done after Russia invaded Ukraine in 2014, is the sanctions were quite strong, but you have to maintain sanctions. Sanctions are not something you can just set and forget. They have to be updated. You have to identify the new companies, the new banks, the cutouts that the Russians are going to use to try to get around them. And then we could also see Russia in negotiations with Ukraine try to insist on some sanctions relief to get back on its feet. And so I think this is going to be a major focus of Russia to try to get around sanctions, to try to minimize their impact. But if they're not able to, then you start looking at what are the tools available to Russia to maintain its great power status. I think the thing that you're going to see is a lot more nuclear signaling, a lot more waving around nuclear threats. We're sort of seeing that already as Russia's military has been ground down in Ukraine to threaten NATO with a nuclear retaliation. I think we're going to see a lot more of that, in some ways akin to North Korea.
Besides the nuclear saber rattling, there's also been discussion that an asymmetrical method for Russia to cause trouble for the West would also be escalating cyber attacks, as well as using its traditional political influence and disinformation campaigns. How effective do you think such activities would be at this juncture?
So I think we've seen over the past 8 years that these activities can be quite effective. But one of the things that Russia had going for it when it launched political interference campaigns against the US, against Europe, other disinformation efforts, is that the West, the US and Europe, were really caught off guard. We weren't prepared for it. We had not assumed that our social media platforms could be sort of weaponized against us or that a foreign country would interfere in our politics. But over the last 8 years, especially over the last six, have intensely focused on this threat. So it's going to be much harder for Russia to deploy certain sort of active measure techniques to the same effect because we're frankly ready for them. Our intelligence services are ready for them. The media has been gotten up to speed on how Russia operates. So I'm not sure those tools will be as effective. Russia, of course, remains a massive cyber power. But I think the one challenge for Russia here is that if they were to take any sort of really aggressive cyber actions against U.S. infrastructure, such as the alleged takedown of the pipeline last year, the Colonial Pipeline in the U.S., which led to gas shortages on the East Coast, the response from the U.S. would be quite strong, much stronger than it was last year. And I think Russia would have to worry that it would potentially be retaliated against and it would just make its economic situation worse. When it comes to the active measures tools, the cyber, the disinformation, Russia could definitely employ those and I think will employ those, but I'm not sure they're going to have the same effect. That said, I think we have to be incredibly on guard because the one thing about the Kremlin is that they are obsessed with geopolitics and are really creative when it comes to hitting back at the West.
Max Bergman, who spent 6 years at the State Department, is currently the CSIS Europe Director. Thank you for being a guest today on VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine.
Thanks so much.
As we have covered previously on this program, Russia's invasion of Ukraine is disrupting crop exports and driving up global food prices. Both countries are major exporters of key staples like wheat and sunflower oil. In France, the European Union's biggest agricultural producer, some farmers sense opportunity, specifically to expand sunflower cultivation. Lisa Bryant reports from the northern French village of Labosse.
Adrien Dupuis took a bet on sunflowers 2 years ago. This year, he's doubled his sunflower cultivation on his farm north of Paris, although it's still fairly small.
Donc le tournesol est une plante relativement facile à cultiver.
Sunflowers are relatively easy to grow. They don't need pesticides or fungicides. The only problem are the birds.
Mais elle ne nécessite pas ni insecticides.
There's another reason for growing sunflowers. Ukraine and Russia, the world's top producers, are at war.
À cause de la guerre, de toute façon,
the war in Ukraine has hiked up prices for sunflower oil. I think they'll remain high for the months to come.
Here and elsewhere in Europe, sunflower oil is becoming hard to find. That's especially a problem when it comes to cooking up France's celebrated fries.
Ukraine is responsible for 30% of global sunflower production. It's responsible for 5% of global wheat production or barley production. So on sunflowers, this is a big effect.
France has temporarily relaxed its food packaging rules so manufacturers can swap sunflower oil for substitutes. While France is among the European Union's top sunflower producers for high-quality oil, it imports standard sunflower oil from Ukraine because it lacks production capacity. France also faces a possible drought. Along with the conflict, dry weather may lead to production shortages for wheat and even hardier sunflowers, pushing prices even higher across Europe in the months to come. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, La Beauce, France.
According to Ukrainian intelligence, as reported by media in Kyiv, Russia has been carrying out covert mobilization of former military personnel, the unemployed, and Russian Cossacks from the southern regions. This reference to the Cossacks caught our eye here at Flashpoint Ukraine, and for more on this aspect, we are joined by Associate Professor Richard Arnold of Muskingum University in the state of Ohio. He is the author of Russian Nationalism and Ethnic Violence, Symbolic Violence, Lynching, Pogrom, and Massacre.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Richard, can you explain to our audience who are the Cossacks? As many people, especially outside Eastern Europe, perhaps remember the term from Tsarist-era Russia pogroms, but that's probably all they know.
So there are three groups of Cossacks. Two of them are Russian and one of them are Ukrainian. Originally, before the era of modern nation states, the Cossacks are believed by most commentators to be descendants of members of the Golden Horde, that is to say, the Mongol tribes that invaded Eurasia way back in the 13th century, 16th and 17th century. The Cossacks, as you rightly point out, were recruited by the Tsars. They were a tribe or a group who lived, some people say they were runaway serfs, some people say they were actually autochthonous or indigenous to that area. But whatever the truth is, they were sellswords. They sold their services to the Polish king, to the Turkish sultan, very rarely, and to the Russian Tsar when they were fighting each other. In 1918, the Cossacks, most of whom fought on the side of the whites in the Russian Civil War, were de-Cossackized. They were ethnically cleansed from their land, and there was some horrific violence accompanying this from the Bolsheviks when they sought to extirpate the Cossacks.
Why would the Cossacks get involved in this war?
In 1997, the Russian government created a register of Cossacks. Putin really appears to have taken that up around 2005. In 2005, he started seeing in the Cossacks a potential movement to provide free labor and to provide security and to provide, most importantly, ideological disinfection, if you like, to fight a kind of ideological war with Western liberalism. And so the Service Cossack movement was born. And the Service Cossacks, who are the ones who are fighting now, are people who say they are Cossacks because they perform government service. They carry out military services for the Russian government, including policing against narcotics in their regions, including patriotic education of youth, and including fighting forest fires and ecological catastrophes and that sort of thing.
The Russian Cossack movement, as far as the war in Ukraine, would you describe them as being united or split?
So a note of caution should be added here. It's hard to tell, of course, because it's very difficult to find information on the Cossacks or on any social movement in Russia these days. There are descendants of Cossacks who call themselves the Free Cossacks, there are service Cossacks who get the title by name of, by dint of doing work for the Russian government. From what I've seen, the ancestral Cossacks are much more unhappy about the war than are the service Cossacks. And the service Cossacks are the ones who are doing the fighting.
There were Cossacks who are in Ukraine. Where do they stand?
For Ukraine, the idea of the Cossack, first of all, there are no real Cossacks at the moment. You know, some people will talk about genetic inheritance and that sort of thing. But for Ukraine, it's an ancestral thing, right? It's an archetypical thing. It's sort of an emblem of their society. And the period of Cossack independence in Ukrainian history has come to be seen as kind of a proto-state for the modern Ukrainian state. It's interesting. There's a Russian insult for Ukrainians called Kokhli, which translates roughly to yokels. But it comes from the stylized haircut the Ukrainian or Zaporizhian Cossacks have, which is a single braid down from the center of the scalp over a shaven scalp.
A fascinating look at a part of history and the Cossacks. Thank you, Richard Arnold, professor at Muskegon University. We appreciate you being on VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine.
Thanks for having me.
Belarusian-American composer Eugene Mogilev has organized an international musical event to honor and show support for Ukraine. Maxim Moskalkov has the story.
Composer Eugene Mogilev was born in Belarus but moved to the U.S. in 1990. When Russia invaded Ukraine on February 24th, Mogilev says he became depressed and found it hard to write music. Then his friend, German professor Ulrich Müller-Doppler, who has Ukrainian roots, called and asked him for help.
He said, "Eugene, would you like to compose a piece for flute players based on Ukrainian folk songs?" And this idea inspired me.
He composed what he calls a Ukrainian potpourri of songs and launched an international musical event to show support for the besieged country. 32 flutists from 23 countries united for the cause. The 4-minute-long piece includes the themes from Ukrainian songs, Nichiyaka Misichna or What a Moonlight Night, and the famous Christmas folk song Shedrik or The Little Sparrow. The potpourri recording took place online.
We thought we would have maybe 15 flutists, about 5 for each of the 3 parts. But the word around this idea got out, and we had twice as many volunteers. These are all very famous flutists in the world of music, as well as their students, orchestra musicians, teachers, professors from 23 countries, including Switzerland, Israel, Poland, and Ukraine, Belarus, France, and USA.
One of the participants is Carissa Janelle Lee, a PhD student from West Virginia University. She previously performed in Russia's Smolensk Philharmonic Hall.
What I've learned is that is all of the musicians that are taking part believe in the same thing, and that is the whole reason for the project. It's to spread peace and to spread love during this time.
Lee's mentor is another famous musician, Kim Scott, who also took part in Magali's potpourri project, together with many seasoned musicians like Ulrich Müller-Doppler and the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra in London's leading flutist, Emmer McDonough.
We call this project Flutist of the World Against War and Aggression. We wish the peoples of Russia and Ukraine to stop the war and start negotiating, to live in peace, play music and perform each other's music, like it's been the case my whole life.
Maxim Moskalkov for VOA News, Washington.
That's it for today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And on our social media platforms, just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Chief National Correspondent, Steve Herman. Have a good evening.
This is the voice of America. Washington, ba-ba-bo-zip. DC.